Excuse me. Are you happy with that park?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
You're way outside the line. You're taking up two spaces.
I'm like an inch over the line.
No, you're a foot over the line. You're taking up two spaces. And the next car is also going to be taking up two spaces. Then you're going to leave. And then that car is going to get blamed. This is chaos. Society can't function like this.
What?
You have to be in the lines the way it's supposed to be.
Here's an idea. Why don't you mind your own business?
Just say, you know what? I'll do better next time.
I did fine.
No, that's not fine.
I don't need to do better.
You didn't do fine. You need to do better. Park your car between the lines. It's not that hard. Look, just pull in between the lines.
Why don't you stay between the lines of your own business, huh? Why don't you stay confined within the lines of not being an a-hole? Because you're way over that line, all right?
The only person who's the a-hole here is the pig Parker.
A pig Parker?
Yes.
So you're calling me a pig?
A pig Parker.
Hey, you know what? Have a real nice day.
Okay, I will. I'm sure you will, too, at everyone else's expense.
TBTL!
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
Look, I can't even listen to NPR anymore, you know? I try to listen and concentrate, and I can't. My mind starts wandering. I get confused.
Oh, wait a minute. Isn't that what's supposed to happen when you listen to NPR?
Please. I hate to say this about anyone, but that man is full of bologna.
Bologna.
You're right. He's so vile, we should use the crude Americanization of the word. He's full of baloney.
They said you were bland.
And dull. And chubby.
Repregnant.
Repugnant.
That's repregnant.
Repugnant.
They said you were jowly.
That's not a word.
All right, hello. Good morning. Welcome, everybody, to a Tuesday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
It's like my heart is trying to hug my brain.
My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host.
I like to party. Do you like to party?
Oh, boy. If you could see what's going on here in the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill. I was doing a TV story last week, and it was on TV this weekend, and it was fine. Everything was good, but I was not happy with my posture. So I was interviewing Jim Belushi. So I'm wearing my special device. I think it's called a bow tie. It's not a bow tie. That doesn't do anything for posture. It's a thing that forces my shoulders to be back and my posture to be correct. And it's making it hard for me to reach the computer and play the audio drops. Here on episode 3,259 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
Looking like a beautiful day here in the Bay City, by the
way. Oh, yeah.
We're getting into the mid-70s, maybe even the 80s. It's like, you ever have a really delicious meal, like a really special meal, and you think to yourself, why can't I sort of do like a squirrel would do and sort of store this away for later? Because there's going to be so many forgettable meals in your life. There's going to be so many just microwaving something, or just if you are a parent, just eating your kid's leftover mac and cheese out of the bowl that was on the high chair. Like, there's so many meals like that that it would be nice if you could take the really special moments and the really delicious moments and just sort of spread them out over time. That's how I'm feeling about the weather that we are enjoying in the Pacific Northwest, because I know that basically after this week it's it's going to be a lot of macaroni and cheese eaten off of high chairs. But anyway, we're going to enjoy today, and we hope you're going to enjoy this episode of TBTL. The CDC has said Halloween may not be canceled, but we need to radically rethink how we celebrate Halloween.
Halloween is that magical day of the year when a child is told their grandmother's a demon.
Get-togethers are frowned upon, of course. Anything that just puts more of us in contact physically with more people who are not in our bubble is a bad thing. I'll tell you who is not taking this lying down. The candy industry. They are spending all kinds of money and energy to try to get the hashtag Halloween is still happening going. To the degree that they've got, there is a candy caucus in the United States Congress. There is a Republican and a Democrat in Congress who are the co-chairs of the Candy Caucus. And their job is to basically push the idea of candy and Halloween. I'll tell you what's going on with that. Also, a study is out that we are all sleeping later during the pandemic.
It's 3:30.
8:30. Why aren't you at work?
Because I didn't feel like it.
And there are some upsides and some downsides to that. One of the upsides is people are apparently experiencing less what is called social jet lag. We're having less of that. But also we could be messing with our circadian rhythm. So we will talk about that. Plus, I have a coffee-related question.
This song goes out to all the coffee lovers of the world.
Kind of a like a science question. And there's only one guy that I know who will be able to answer it, and it's my friend, the longest-running Cobro of the show, known for his drawings of tall ships, Andrew Walsh, who is joining us right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, my friend.
Hey, hot stuff.
Ooh, thank you.
Yeah, well, don't thank me. Thank TJ. Listener TJ writing in to say, Luke, I saw the Jim Belushi interview. Well done, and you are hot. Peace.
Well, TJ, appreciate it, but I don't know if you noticed my posture. I could only describe it as Hans Molman-esque, which, see, the problem is when you're doing one of those TV things and they have multiple cameras set up, we call it the sit-down in the industry. There's one camera that's pointing at your face, which I have this instinct to lean a little bit forward, so it kind of sort of low-keys my double chin. But then there's another camera that's shooting your profile. And then all your secrets are exposed because from the side, you could see that I'm just doing a weird slouch lean forward thing. So hence me being in here with my contraption on. But TJ, thank you for the positive feedback. It is honestly probably giving me life right now.
You know, I guess I have bad news for Rainn Wilson, because I told you back in the day, especially when he was on The Office and I was a younger man and I didn't have a beard, I would often get compared to him. People said I looked remarkably like him. And then time went on, and he's a famous person who took care of himself. I am a not famous person who did the opposite, and we went our own ways on that journey. But I've been hearing from, I saw somebody posting on this on social media. I've heard Genevieve say this, but apparently Rainn Wilson is in a new project. I can't remember exactly what it is.
It's the one that I mentioned the other day, Utopia, that I was upset about, because I feel like it really pushes a QAnon adjacent worldview.
Right. And did we play that? I don't remember seeing him, but I'm hearing that he's back at Andrew State, which is bad news. But I've been hearing some more comparisons to me looking like him, which is a real bummer for him.
I don't agree with that, Andrew. And as a girlfriend of mine in college used to say, your subconscious can't take a joke. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, when you say that kind of thing, says the guy wearing a back brace right now because he was embarrassed about his posture on television. It's fine when I'm self-critical, Andrew. I'm allowed to do it. But I actually saw a clip of Rainn Wilson in that TV show, and I thought, oh, he looks nice. That was literally a thought that went through my brain. I mean, the thing that's misleading is, as Dwight Schrute, he was sort of actively working against what is a naturally pleasant face. You know what I mean? Like it's almost like what's another example of that? Well, to some degree, John Heder in Napoleon Dynamite. Anytime you see the guy who played Napoleon Dynamite and he's not in that getup, you're like, oh, wow, you're a nice-looking guy. And some of that is just the contrast between being their normal selves and being someone who's actively trying to look a little bit kind of silly. Mm-hmm. So, but I thought when I saw that Utopia thing, I thought, oh, Rainn Wilson looks nice. So if you're getting compared to him in Utopia, that, my friend, is a compliment. They're thinking, or they're saying, Andrew Walsh also looks nice.
Well, what I like is that TJ, and by the way, nobody sent that, I think, directly to me. I saw chatter about it, and Genevieve mentioned it, so I don't know if anybody meant it as a compliment. So I'm not trying to weave observations into compliments here, but I do like the unambiguity, if that is a word, of TJ's comment. Nice job on the story, and you are hot, Luke.
Man, I will take it. The topic of Utopia came up the other day because, again, I'm in an anxious state, as I think we all. I think, honestly, no matter where you are on the political sort of continuum, you're anxious, because if you're like me and your team not the current president, you feel like the Cleveland Browns with a 14-point lead and 7 minutes left. You think, like, the statistics say we're going to win this, but hey, we've found a way to lose it before. And even if you're on the other side, I think you look at those numbers, and as much as you try to say fake news, fake polls, you know somewhere in your heart that your guy's in a lot of trouble. And every day brings more news that I think, you know, makes it harder on this, the chances of this guy winning. But anyway, some of that anxiety has manifest itself around me just being mad at random television shows like Utopia. Mm-hmm. And I saw a headline today because, you know, that's actually a series that was written by, I'm going to say Gillian Flynn. I don't know how she pronounces it. I assume Gillian. Gillian Flynn is the writer who also wrote Gone Girl, wrote Sharp Objects. And the headline, I forget, maybe this was like The Atlantic or something, was like Gillian Flynn is obsessed with conspiracies. And I was like, exactly, this is the whole problem. Don't write about a deep state world conspiracy that only a few people know about. That's like, you know, like, please don't do that. But then the article was just a friendly interview with Gillian Flynn. And I was like, is anyone going to call her on the carpet over this? Mm. I guess not yet.
Well, maybe that's your next CBS piece. I want to I want to keep things light, so I don't know how much I actually want to ask this question, but I legit do want to know. And, you know, as our dear friend P. Fletch once described TBTL, if you go back and listen to old episodes, it is a way of kind of time stamping where we were in the past. So I guess to that end, I want to ask you about a televised event tonight. Of course, I'm talking about the first presidential debate between Biden and Trump, and whether or not you plan on watching that. I'll just preface this by saying, in the past, I've said on the show that for the most part, debates make me very anxious, especially when there's a whole bunch of people on stage, because it's often mismanaged and it's just a lot of like kind of who's the loudest, which doesn't really seem to do any good. And I don't like people hollering. And, you know, for me, seeing Trump have any kind of a huge platform like this, I usually just avoid it because it causes so much anxiety for me. And so I had no intention of watching it until about yesterday. It became like a priority for me. And now I'm trying to schedule my day and get a bunch of stuff done so that I can be ready to watch this this debate that starts at 6 o'clock. And I don't know if I'm going to make it or not, but I'm also just wondering where you are on this journey and if I'm crazy for wanting to watch it, since I can just find out everything that happened afterwards anyway.
Did your interest in it go up because of the New York Times reporting around the taxes stuff?
No, I hate to admit this, but I don't know why it went up, but it might have just been
You're just a Chris Wallace head?
Yeah, actually, well, you know, but
I did appreciate the interview he did, you know, with Trump, you know, however many months ago that was. It was actually fairly cathartic.
Yeah, and actually, like, as far as a debate moderator goes, I'd put him pretty high up on my list.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, I hate to admit this, it might have just been, like, the saturation. Not even – I think they're running – during the Sunday football games, both of them were on Fox, and they were running promos. So for, like, 6 hours, if you count 2 3-hour football games, I just saw promo after promo after promo for it. It was all the same promo. It was mixed terribly. You couldn't even hear what Biden was saying in the soundbite. Veeves and I rolled it back a bunch. It was – I don't know if they did that on purpose. I kind of doubt it. But it wasn't even a good promo. But maybe just 6 hours of having that promo smashed over my head, suddenly I was like, must watch that TV.
Somebody wrote on Twitter, I think – I can't remember who retweeted it, if it was Chris or maybe Stu. But somebody said, Biden should just walk into the debate stage like he's like lost and doesn't know where he is. And then he should just grab the mic and say, welcome to the terror dome. And then just like stare directly into Trump's eyes and just see what happens. I mean, to answer your question, I have gone back and forth with it. Initially, I thought, well, I need to watch it just as a member of this society and this country. I should know what's going on. Then I had the same thought you did, which is it's really upsetting to me to watch Donald Trump operate in the public sphere. Like, it just really bothers me, and it leaves me feeling worse about the world because it makes me contemplate the fact that there are people who thought this guy should be president and still think that, at least some people. So then I was like, maybe I'll just watch the highlights. What's really got me, probably the decision for me is I might not watch it, but it's because my dad's coming over. So my mom is traveling right now. She's in Philly, and my dad is over on this side of the water. He's going to be doing some work in Seattle today, and so he's going to come up and we're going to have a little, you know, a little dinner or something, and that will be happening around the time the debate's happening. And to be honest, I don't want to watch the debate with my dad for a couple reasons. One, I'm trying to still stay socially distant, And, you know, sitting in a room watching the debate, that's going to be kind of probably pushing that 6-foot rule unless we're wearing masks, which would feel a little extra indoors. But also, like, my dad's not a Trump guy at all. In fact, my dad is actively anti-Trump now. But I don't know. That's just an intense experience. And I could watch it with you and Genevieve, because I think we're on exactly the same page, and we would just be all – it'd be like watching a football game. We would just be like – when Biden scores a point, we're all going to be high-fiving and like, you know, yes. But it just seems like a complicated thing with my dad, who, again, is not a Trumper but is probably not as progressive as I am. And so for that reason, I probably won't watch it when it happens. What I will probably do is later that night I will go and – and interpret it through the lens of the New York Times, MSNBC, maybe Fox News as just sort of, opposition research, because I do like to see what they're saying about things. I'm just always curious if anything will ever stick to that side of the world, and of course it doesn't. I mean, their response to the truly damning reporting in the New York Times was to bring Eric Trump on to talk about, like, Biden's taxes or something. So did you see that article? Now we're just going to do this. There was a quite interesting article about the Fox News decision desk.
No, I didn't see this. Where was it? In the Times?
Probably. You know, because there is a nightmare scenario where Fox News is pressured by Trump to declare. Let's say he's leading in some early ballots like Pennsylvania or something. And there is this concern that there would be worry that Trump picks up the phone and starts leaning on, you know, his cronies over there to basically call the race for him, even though it's not anywhere near decided, and that just creates all kinds of confusion, et cetera. Well, there's a guy who's actually a registered Democrat. I don't remember his name, but he's like this very sort of like bespectacled, mild, described as being sort of a mild-mannered, just kind of numbers guy who is in charge of the decision desk at Fox. And he runs this little independent team. They're contractors at Fox. They've been doing this for years. And they kind of operate, apparently, with, like, no one's really in charge of them. So there is this weird firewall that exists. And it could very well be that the future of our republic comes down to this dude at Fox at his desk just being like, hold off. The decision desk is not weighing in on this yet. So I hope that guy takes his bite. He's the new RBG to me. I hope he is taking his vitamins. Mm-hmm. I hope he is doing push-ups. Stay strong, decision desk dude, because we need you.
Yeah, no, I hadn't read that. I remember, it's weird that I would bring this up because I don't know the details at all. And if you don't, this is just such a waste of tape. And even tape being less than free now, it's still a waste of everybody's tape. But it was the, wasn't it the 2012 presidential election? Something crazy went down at Fox. And there was like a Steadicam or a handheld camera following somebody like marching down the election HQ hallway to get to the decision desk. Does that ring a bell to you at all? There was some craziness going on.
Yeah, I do remember. I remember something along those lines of being.
I wish I could remember better.
Like, because obviously they wanted it called. You know, the on-air people wanted it called. By the way, the guy, his name is Arnon Mishkin. He's described as a bespectacled 65-year-old, and his staff of data-crunching wonks who come to work on election day. On November 3rd, Mr. Mishkin may be the last bulwark against the most frightening prophecies of electoral insanity. This is actually a piece by Ben Smith in the Times. Ben Smith, who I think was one of the co-founders of BuzzFeed. Now he writes media stuff for the New York Times. Anyway, all of that is to say, I don't know if I'll watch it in real time, but I will, of course, be up to speed on it by tomorrow or probably by later tonight. Because, yeah, again, you know, I saw some just – this is going to be the episode of this show where I just repeat things I saw on Twitter. But I did – this was something that was retweeted by our friend the Stewbot. It was somebody saying, look, you are not obligated to watch the debate if it's triggering for you, if it's anxiety producing. And I think he said – this person who was tweeting said, there will be the Twitter scolds who tell you that you're not doing your job as an American if you're not watching this. But I actually agree with that tweet. I don't think that you have to do it. If it puts you in a place that's emotionally doesn't feel totally safe or doesn't feel like a good emotional place for you, I don't think you have to watch the debate. I do think it's worth informing yourself on what the takeaways were
and seeing other people who you trust interpret the events and maybe looking at polls if you feel okay about that. But I don't think any of us have to run a cheese grater over our eyes if we don't want to, watching this known liar stand in public and continue his lies.
Yeah, and I don't think I feel any outside pressure. I mean, maybe that is part of it. Maybe like inside me there's some sort of ticking little clock. I don't know, ticking clock. I don't know what I'm talking about. But maybe there's some little voice in me that says, well, this is your duty. I don't think so, though, because, you know, growing up in the somewhat modern media age, or at least coming of age during this time, like, I've always kind of had an attitude, even if it's like Obama giving a State of the Union address, which is not at all like, for me, rubbing my eyes on a cheese grater or whatever you said, like, that's fine. I still think that I would say to myself, oh, if I can watch this, great. If not, like, it'll all be in the papers, like, literally immediately it'll be in the papers, and the next morning it'll be in the papers. So I don't think I often had the feeling of I'm not a good citizen if I'm not watching this live. Some things we're just compelled to watch live, and for some reason, again, maybe it was the crappy promo, maybe it was just waking up on a different side of the bed, but for some reason I'm now like, oh man, I gotta watch this thing tonight. I'm just compelled to. I want to see it happen. But the more we talk about it, and again, like, kind of misscheduled my day today, so I have a bunch of stuff stacking up right before that, and maybe I'm actually feeling better, like, you know what, maybe it's just better not to watch it live, just like do what I gotta do, and maybe tune in for the end of it and find out what happened. But I have a feeling it's not going to be a enjoyable experience no matter what happens, even as you
well,
say, even if Biden gets quote-unquote points, like, I just, it's never going to be comfortable for me.
Well, the thing I think people should prepare themselves for emotionally is, and this has just been the experience of watching this deranged human as he ran for president and became president, is, I mean, Biden will be making what I assume is a somewhat cogent argument tonight, and he'll be bringing up reasonable points, and Trump will be lying and flailing. And at the end, Fox News will say that Trump scored points, and the people who are his hardest core supporters will think that he won. And so it's this, again, it's this kind of divergence from a fact-based reality that I think bothers a lot of us. And you're setting yourself up for that. Like, there's not going to be a point in the debate where Trump goes, good one, Joe. Man, I hadn't thought of it that way. And then his supporters, the scales fall from their eyes in, you know, central Pennsylvania, where he's still somehow polling above Biden. You know, like, that's just not going to happen. And so if anyone goes in watching it for that outcome, I just don't think that's going to be the outcome. Like,
yeah,
I was quite shocked to see a stat today that there's like 1 in 10 voter has still not made up their mind. What? I don't understand how anybody could not have. I mean, of course, I don't understand anyone could support Trump, but I don't understand how anybody could look at these two people and think, boy, coin toss.
Mm-hmm. When I know I've said this before on the show, and it's like, to me, it's the epitome of my naivete when it comes to politics. But I remember being a kid, or like, just old enough to be to understand politics to the most superficial degree, but not really following it. And I remember having what I thought was like a really wise theory as a kid, which is like, I would always vote for the guy who changed his mind on stage, right? Like, if there was a debate and somebody said, man, I never thought about it like that, but you actually have a really good point there. That's something we could work on together. I'd be like, that's my person. I'm voting for that person, which of course is not how it works. I just want to point out here that when I Googled that 2012 election desk event, the first thing that came up was an Atlantic article called "The Time Karl Rove Took on the Fox News Decision Desk." It's literally that desk that you're talking about.
Right.
Basically, what happened is all the networks called it for Ohio, including the Fox Decision Desk. But the pundits on TV, including Karl Rove and apparently Chris Wallace, were skeptical of that call. So it was none other than Megyn Kelly here who takes
her
microphone.
Calling it for?
They were calling it for Obama. My apologies. They were calling it for Obama, and the Fox pundits did not like that and were skeptical of it, and so it looks like Megyn Kelly takes the microphone and tells the cameras to follow her, and she marches towards the decision desk that you were just describing. So
that thing better be in like a vault, or like, you know, like in a submarine, how you can close that door with that, like, with that wheel that you spin closed, so if there's a breach, the water won't get into each chamber of the sub. They better have old Arnon Mishkin in one of those setups with just, like, weld it shut run a Wi-Fi router into there and protect him at all costs, him and his team, please.
I would like to know how many people listening, when you were describing those doors, I want to know how many people out there were picturing Deep Blue Sea, the movie where LL Cool J, I believe, takes on a shark. I've never seen the movie, but for some reason, as you were describing that wheeled door, that was exactly what I was picturing. I think
I would guess the number is one, and it was you, my friend.
And it was, well, I don't know. We have tons of listeners.
When you reference an LL Cool J submarine movie, your friend is you.
Let's talk about that shit for a second, can't we? I know you want to get into the science of coffee. Yeah, but during the football games, I'm stuttering. I keep on hearing myself stutter. During the football games yesterday, again, they were all on Fox, so we were seeing the same kind of commercials over and over. Did you see the new Lincoln commercial? You don't see McConaughey in it, but you hear his voiceover coming in. It's almost like it's almost distorted, like it's coming in over a telephone, and it's mixed with music. I actually kind of like the mix, but he's just spouting off more psychobabble bullshit, and it is so irritating to me. And I think that the only thing that they should do now, if I am running that, I would have Busey. I replace him with Busey because what's Busey's first name?
Gary.
Gary Busey. No, I was talking about Jake, Luke. No. Replace him with Gary Busey because, like, what he's saying is just as stupid, and he just says it in a way that kind of makes him sound like he's got a real line.
It's not advice. It's sharing information from the heart and the spiritual level.
Mm-hmm. Stuff like
just,
that?
Yeah, just dig into it. Like, go full Busey. Screw this McConaughey crap.
Okay. I mean, we could actually just forward over some of these audio drops.
You are, to me, when you're working, an innocent champion of honesty.
Yeah, let me see if I can find... Well, you do that. I'm going to find the commercial.
How about...
When life gives you lemons, make lemonade. When life cracks your head, use a helmet.
It sounds like it's a little bit too late there.
It's easy. Okay. It's a mind that's open to everything, yet attached to nothing.
I think that would definitely describe McConaughey, a mind that's open to everything but attached to nothing. All right, all right, all right.
I don't think, is this the new one? I don't think, no, the only one I can find now is the one where he's ice fishing, which is not the one I'm looking for. Right. I really wish I could play this for you because if you could hear what he's saying in Busey's voice, you would know exactly what I'm talking about.
Things like that.
Welcome to the Institute for Entrepreneurial Nonsense. First of all, think outside the box. The guy who invented Pringles packaging thought outside the box and made a fortune. In fact, he was buried in the tube. Mm-hmm. Isn't that beautiful?
Yep.
I will say that those McConaughey commercials, the previous ones where we were commenting on how deeply lonely he appears to be, because he's always just like, he's like in his house getting ready by himself, and then like later he's like at a poker game with his friends for 1 second. I probably mentioned this before, but one of the friends in that poker game I used to play basketball with at the Y in L.A., apropos of not much, but then he's like reflecting on the poker game, but he seems to be alone again, or he's like at that lake by himself. In all of that, I will say this is how suggestible I am. I do like that whole feature of the lights when you open the door, like, which is one of the like product shots, you know what I mean, on that particular vehicle. When you open the door, it like shines a light down on the ground.
So down on the ground.
So you're not stepping into darkness.
Yeah.
And then, so that's kind of appealing. And also, I really like his house. And some part of my brain says, well, if I buy that car, then maybe I'll have that house, which isn't really how any of that works. But
yeah,
I will say
that. You have a pretty cool house.
I do. There's nothing wrong with my house. I don't need a different house. But I'm just admitting to the fact that I'm not usually. I'm the kind of person that when I watch a commercial, it's not usually the message 0%, you know, APR or whatever that gets me. It's not the writing in the commercial. It's the kind of what it represents and if that connects emotionally with me about a thing that I desire, like a world I desire to inhabit. And while I don't want to be a deeply lonely McConaughey, I wouldn't mind being a handsome, although I just learned recently that I'm hot stuff. So maybe
that's
maybe it is working. But you know what I mean? It's like there's something about just they do paint a world in that commercial, at least as far as the physical objects, the house, the driveway even. I feel like there's something I like about his driveway, the light on the car. I wish I was more immune to those commercials than I am, considering kind of how weird they are.
Okay, here's what I've figured out. I think I have found the commercial I'm talking about, although it's only a 15-second version, so I'm hoping this is the right thing and it pays off. There was another weird a weird aspect of this commercial, which was it didn't show McConaughey. It showed this like this bearded singer-songwriter guy who I had not heard of before. His name is Cass Haley, and he's like driving to a gig. He looks like,
okay.
I don't know who this guy is, but he looks like the type of guy who would be in that band, like, as I described to Genevieve, like, Johnny Fieldhand in the Night Sweats or whatever that band is that has all the boot stomping and everything. Like, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I think you might. I think there's a couple of things. Yeah, you might be thinking of, well, there's two versions. There's one like Nathan Ratliff and the Night Sweats.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yep.
And then there's one called like St. Paul and the Broken Bones. And it's always like, it seems like it's typically a white dude and there's like a huge backing band. It was like 30 or 40 people in the backing, but four of them on trombone alone.
Yeah,
and it's kind
right.
of it's a sure. sort of it's a white reinterpretation of what might be a sort of traditionally black music sound. But then the foot stomping thing that tends to go more in the Lumineers, the hey ho, we look like we were riding on a boxcar because the revenuers were after us because we had been moonshining.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking. Yeah, that's the more kind of hipstery, almost like on the edge of twee shit that was happening. You know, like what, like almost 10 years ago now. I'm talking about the more like, you know, the unfortunate facial hair in some way, hats that are slightly too small for the fat white heads that are underneath it. I'm talking about that kind of music. And apparently this guy, Cass Haley, won. I'm just finding this out now. Cass Haley won a contest to be in this commercial. So that's,
got
you
it.
Know, it is. So, but I think if I hit play on this, this is the one where you see this guy, he's driving to a gig via these long, windy roads. And I think you're going to hear our boy McConaughey talking here. And if I'm right about this, try to picture instead Jake or Gary Busey, preferably
any Busey will do.
Knowing who we are is hard. It's hard. Eliminate who you are not first, and you're going to find yourself where you need to be.
Yeah, that's a short.
The future's a mystery.
For a second, I thought that was actually on the tape. I was like, that's perfect. I swear there was a longer version of that, but that gives you a taste of what we're talking about there.
Yeah. All right. I still haven't even gotten to my coffee question, Andrew, which is where started things 25 or so minutes ago. So let's do this quick break, and then we'll come back. And I want to get your I want to get your feedback on this theory. It has to do with hydrodynamics, coffee, caffeine levels, and a whole bunch of other things. But we're going to do that right after this. This is TBTL.
Thank you, baby.
Let's thank some donors of the day. Thank you, baby. Generous people keeping the show going, and we appreciate it. How about Brooks Wilson of Boise, Idaho? How about that?
How about that? Is that what you want?
Brooks up there? Is Brooks up there on the bench? The mensch on the bench? Is Brooks one of the menches on the benches?
I'm not sure.
Thank you, Brooks. We appreciate it. How about Marissa Collins of Columbia, Maryland, still maybe smarting from a Monday Night Football defeat last night, but boy, oh boy, Kansas City, that's a team for you. I mean, as are the Ravens. I know you were happy to see the Ravens lose, Andrew, as a Browns partisan, but we like that Marissa is donating to the show. We hope if you are a football fan, everything, the odds are ever in your favor. Megan Dahl of Seattle, Washington.
Now that's
thank
a
you.
Football Ryan, team right there.
Yeah, it is. As long as that team scores 70 points a game, we may go undefeated. How about Ryan Dietzman of St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Minnesota? Thank you, Ryan. Wolfgang Weber. What do you think? We going Wolfgang because we're in the States, because we're stateside?
Let's see. Wolfgang Weber.
This comes
or
up
Wolfgang
every year we read
Weber.
Wolfgang's name.
I'm going to go Wolfgang Weber. That's me. But you can go more international.
No, I'm going to go. I bet you when Wolfgang introduces himself around the San Francisco area, he says, hey, I'm Wolfgang.
Yeah, probably.
And were he in Germany, I think that might change. But this is America. Love it or leave it, Wolfgang. Oh, wait. I mean,
wow.
Thank you for the donation.
Interesting.
Catherine Damon of Wamego, Kansas. I wonder what's going down in Wamego, Kansas. That sounds like a fun place.
Do you think Catherine's last name could be Demand? Like, Catherine, you Demand.
No, but I bet you she gets that joke a lot.
Yeah, it was pretty good. A lot of funny people out there.
I want to visit Wamego, Kansas. Oh, it's in Pottawatomie County. It's Wamego, small town, big experience. Population 4,372. Oh, interesting. They've got an Oz museum, as in Wizard of.
Oh, Kansas.
Oh, yeah, we are in Kansas anymore. I know that doesn't make grammatical sense, but I just liked saying it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's see. It's part of the Manhattan, Kansas Metropolitan Statistical Area. And let's see. It's the home of a museum dedicated to the Wizard of Oz, featuring a collection of over 25,000 Oz artifacts on a permanent loan from somebody named Friar John Paul Caferio, who I'm assuming is a man of the cloth who also had a lot of Wizard of Oz stuff.
Wow. That seems like an interesting combination of interests.
Prominent Oz-related businesses include the Oz Winery, the Lincoln Street Station, Barleycorns, and wait for it, Andrew, Toto's Tacos. Ooh. Tacos spelled T-A-C-O-Z.
Ooh, I don't know if I like the spelling.
Wamego holds its annual Oztoberfest, which is an Oktoberfest-type celebration with an Oz theme. I could get down with that.
Yeah, not this year, though, and maybe more on that when it's time to talk about Halloween later on in the show.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep this coffee thing short, because there's really not that much here. Yesterday, I was running a little behind schedule, and so I put the coffee on, and I had to come in here. I had to have an early meeting before we recorded TBTL, but I felt I was in desperate need of coffee, because I haven't been sleeping great. More on that coming up in Top Stories as well. I ran out to the coffee pot, which now had like a half a cup of coffee in it. And I poured that coffee into my cup. I came in, I had my meeting, and then I commented to Carrie, that coffee was way too strong. And she said, it's because it was the very first bit of the coffee, and it hadn't had time, like the pot had not filled up, it was not diluted enough. And my mind said, that can't be true, right? Because each amount of water as it passes through the grounds should have the same amount of flavor going into it. Or is it that the beginning of the brew is stronger because the grounds have more caffeine in them, more groundiness? I think that's the term they use at Broadcast Coffee. And so the beginning is going to be the strongest because the grounds are the freshest and the least sort of poured over. And then at the end, it's going to be less strong, and when you mix it all together, you get the right amount for me. Which one do you think?
I think my mind is blown right now because it is so rare that I do what I did this morning, but I did exactly what you're talking about. And I looked at the show sheet and you said, I have a coffee question. And as I was sipping from my coffee, which I had poured before the entire pot was done being made, and I thought, ugh, that's way too bitter.
Uh-huh.
I thought, is there any chance that we have the same exact coffee question this morning? I almost asked you before the show if that's your coffee question. We are living the same damn life in two different cities. My mind is blown. I'm not joking.
Dude, my clock just stopped at 5 hours, 55 minutes, and 55 seconds.
Okay, and let me bolster this so I can explain to you why this happens to me so rarely, because I mentioned we have a new coffee pot now, or a new coffee maker, and that allows me to do that. My old coffee maker had that same spring mechanism on the bottom of the basket, so technically you could pull the pot out while it's still brewing and pour a little bit for yourself if you're impatient. But I stopped doing that years ago because the spring sucked.
And so it would just dump coffee.
Yeah, not too bad, but it would drip way too much on the burner, and then you get the smelly, the smelly burning coffee when you put the craft back in, all that. So I stopped doing that. Today, I was running super late. I made the coffee. I'm running around. I look over at it. Only about one cup had been made so far, but I'm like, I have this new coffee maker. It's not going to drip all over. I can banana grab that first cup of coffee. And I poured it and I took a sip and I was like, whoa, I forgot that it's way too bitter because it's not fully made and it's not fully balanced. And then I wondered, but wait, does that make sense? Because it's still water passing through you know, a sediment essentially to, not sediment, but it's water passing through a flavor of ground up beans. But yeah, it must be that by the end, the water that's pouring through those beans, the beans don't have, the ground beans don't have as much flavor at that point. So it's balancing out the whole pot, right? That's got to be it.
That has to be it, because it was, we both had the exact same experience. Yesterday, I was like, this is insanely bitter. And I mean, if you just think about it logically, I love, though, that we were able to do basically a double-blind test on this without even coordinating. Yeah. I was doing it yesterday, and you were doing it today. We got the same result, which tells me it must just be the case that the first, you know, amount is going to be more bitter because of all the reasons we've already stated. So actually, you know, it's kind of – this is sort of great, because I feel like I have what for me is a satisfactory answer to this question, and now I know.
Do you want me to text Barry, broadcast Barry, a coffee entrepreneur? Or are we comfortable with our answer? Let me text him, see if I can answer by the end of the show, okay?
Okay, good. And then I'll fire this little sound effect while you're doing that.
Hello, and welcome to Top Story.
Our top story from a website called thecounter.org. It was a piece by Sam Block. Actually, I have to tell you, this website, thecounter.org, is very interesting. It is apparently a nonprofit that just reports on the food industry. And I think the reason you have to be a nonprofit if you're going to report on the food industry is because all the other websites reporting on the food industry are probably sponsored by some giant lobbying group that is, you know, lobbying on behalf of some part of the food industry. So this would appear, at least if their About Us page is to be believed, to be a non-biased source on food. Like, what I noticed is that I was clicking around this website, I saw four or five stories, and I was like, ooh, that's kind of interesting to me. Mm-hmm. How the candy industry convinced us that hashtag Halloween is happening despite COVID-19. Sam Block mentioning that the CDC this week released a new health and safety guidance for Halloween. In order to try to minimize, obviously, the spread of the virus. Among the recommendations from the CDC, no door-to-door trick-or-treating, no costume parties, no haunted houses, no hayrides, even costume masks should be they're nervous about that because they feel that people will wear costume masks in lieu of actual masks, and then the costume mask will not actually prevent viral spread. So if you go to if everyone comes to a party and there's 100 people packed into a house and they're like, well, we're wearing masks, but the mask is, a kitty cat or some weird ass thing from Eyes Wide Shut, you could still be super spreading. The other thing that I thought was kind of crazy was they're worried, the CDC is worried, that one of the hallmarks of Halloween is screaming.
Oh, yeah.
And the CDC writes, if screaming is likely to occur, then greater distancing is advised. That never even occurred to me. But of course, screaming would be a very bad, a very vectory thing. And this is a holiday built around the idea of screaming.
Do they mention, I only read the first half of this article, then I saw something shiny. Do they get it all into bobbing for apples? Because that's a holiday tradition that seems definitely on the edge during COVID times.
They do not specifically mention apple bobbing. But the big takeaway is that we have to really rethink Halloween. This, though, Andrew, comes as a major threat to something called the NCA, the National Confectioners Association. They represent 600 candy manufacturers, suppliers, and brokers, and they have launched an aggressive press campaign to try to get this hashtag going, Halloween is happening. One press release on August 10th read this, quote, one thing is for sure, Halloween is happening. August 18th, another press release. 96% of parents plan to celebrate Halloween. It's pretty funny because, like, I understand that, like, this is how big business works in this country. I mean, I did a story last year about Halloween candy, and I went out to the Mars factory, and they were very happy to have me out there because, of course, they want to promote their products. So maybe I'm part of the industrial Halloween candy machinery myself, unwittingly so. But I get that this is what happens. This is how company and Lord knows Halloween candy is probably the least, one of the less nefarious companies that's, you know, lobbying with all these BS press releases and things. I mean, I would take a candy company over Exxon, right? But it's just there's something that just has the waft of desperation. One thing is for sure, Halloween is happening.
Yeah.
You know, 96% of parents plan to celebrate Halloween. They got this they got the Congressional Candy Caucus to weigh in on this, which involves a Democrat, Ann Custer of New Hampshire. And
so close to custard, which is another sweet treat.
Yeah. Good. And I hope I'm saying that right. It's K-U-S-T-R. Hmm. Maybe it's Custer, but Anne is from New Hampshire, a Democrat, and Jackie Walarski is a Republican from Indiana. They, of course, are the co-chairs of the Congressional Candy Caucus. This lobbying organization has been, I assume, dumping plenty of money and or candy into the coffers of these people that are on the Candy Caucus, so much so that in August, these two were part of a bipartisan group of 30 members of Congress who signed a letter to Robert Redfield, the director of the CDC, to publicly comment on alternative Halloween activities. So, like, you're in charge of the CDC. You got a lot going on. And I know Robert Redfield, there are some real questions around, if he's able to act independently of the president or not. He had that appearance in front of Congress that seemed a little bit recently that seemed a little bit difficult to pin down. He was saying a lot of different things. Anybody, even if it's Tony Fauci, it's like any of these public officials, Deborah Birx, it's like you're hoping they're giving out good information, but you also feel all the time like Donald Trump is standing just out of the frame holding a loaded weapon. Robert Redfield, I don't know if he's done well with this, if he's done poorly. The initial response was obviously not the greatest. That being said, the fact that they're putting pressure on him to publicly comment on alternative Halloween activities so they can sell more candy is like, everybody calm down.
Yes. I'm not a huge Halloween candy person myself, but I was in the grocery store the other day, as all of my stories being in there. This isn't mm-hmm. even really a story, but I did notice, those not pallets, but like those open boxes when it's a seasonal sale of something, mm-hmm. they just put the boxes out there and they rip them open and then you can like just go rummaging through them. I saw big stacks of these boxes of candy that were open at the top and I was like, is it just because I could see a world where people are like, listen, there's not trick or treating this year, but we do have these seasonal traditions. And part of that is me eating too much candy. And so it's going to be a little bit sadder this year, but I'm going to get my traditional bag of assorted Hershey's brand chocolates or whatever. And I'm going to get a little pumpkin. I even bought a little pumpkin the other day, by the way. I bought one about the size small little volleyball, just a little guy. And I just saw it and it was cute. And I was like, sure, we can feel festive and kind of slip into the season, but we have obviously adjust. I'm not pro trick or treating, but apparently there is this thing. I'm not usually like this. I was reading this today and trying to think like, would I have different feelings if, there are, a lot of people I'm sure in this country whose income relies on going to a factory that makes candy, right? So I was like, well, if that was me or somebody in my family, would I feel different about this? Would I be hashtagging Halloween is still happening, right?
Please,
probably not. But I mean, that gets into all of the work and what's going on in the country, and not to get into broader political issues. But the government should have, given everybody more stimulus so that we don't have to go into these dangerous situations, whether it's candy factories, and we know those are dangerous because they have these potions that you can take that make you float, and you'll float right into a fan. I mean, where's OSHA on that? You got to burp,
honestly,
Charlie. Burp.
Like the majority of spoiled children that go into candy factories do not emerge alive.
That is. And where's that in the press releases? I don't know.
Get on that, thecounter.com.
Yeah.
Andrew, I will tell you this, though. The crazy part is I don't know how much of this you could attribute to Halloween is still really happening, but candy sales are up over this time last year. Halloween candy and also just generally throughout the pandemic from March 15th until September 6th. So, since things got real serious here in the U.S., candy sales are up by 4%. Candy has proved to be very pandemic proof. And I think it's for exactly the reasons you were kind of starting to describe, Andrew, which is You walk into a store, nothing feels normal. A lot of people really love Halloween. It's a really fun chance to get dressed up, or your kids obviously love it, and you want to take your kids out. I mean, listen, I just take my kid trick-or-treating and all that stuff. Like, I don't have a heart of stone. I'm not anti-Halloween. But I can see somebody walking into a store and thinking, well, if everything's going to kind of be modified in a little, if we're going to have a stupid Zoom Halloween this year, at the very least, I'm going to buy a couple of these bags of assorted candy and have those around the house, because it'll at least feel like something that reminds me of normalcy, which I completely understand. And I could see myself grabbing a bag of that stuff just to have it around here. And then I could also see myself, Andrew, eating all of it. I have a very weird relationship with candy, which is that I do not crave it really at all most of the time. I very rarely purchase it. But if it is in the house, I will consume all of it over time. And it's weird for something that I just don't think about on a day-to-day basis. Once it's like when we in years past do a Halloween thing and there's just like a big ass bowl, because no one ever comes to Burbank Springs to trick or treat. There's a big ass bowl of candy, and I will just work my way through the whole thing.
How many of those do you eat during the day? Do you eat any
Zero.
Of it? Yeah, me too. I mean, that's the and I kind of assume that you and I have the same weaknesses, which is I'm the same way. Like, you could put a bowl of Halloween candy on the dining room table, and all day long I'll pass it. I won't even be so much as tempted. But then, yeah, the clock strikes, I don't know, 11:30, and then you're like, well, I think I'm going to have my third dinner of the night, and it will be these candy bars, maybe with some milk splashed over it.
Well, ooh. Like Wait cereal. A second.
No,
Stop
I was just making
the
that
show.
Up.
Because if you do that, that is an interesting move, and I think that bears
some that examination.
Bears more examination. I wonder if people are doing that. You know, that sounds like a crazy thing to do, but we've already talked about how much breakfast cereal is just on the line of being candy anyway.
Yes, like, exactly.
And I would eat a Kit Kat and drink some milk potentially. So is it that different if I just throw a little in the bowl with it and kind of make a slurry? I don't know. Wow. But for me, the journey is if I'm having a good day where I've been very self-disciplined, and even at dinner, maybe I, you know, was kind of careful about what I ate, or I kept my portion control in check or whatever, then I might not go ham on like 3 or 4 or 10 mini Kit Kat bars. But if I've already just kind of like given up on myself and life on a given night, so like I'm just eating a bunch of food that's probably not particularly great for me, then those are the days where I just go, dude, you already ruined it. Enjoy yourself. You know, treat yourself. Mm-hmm. You might as well top off the unhealthy dinner you had with an unhealthy amount of sugary candy at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that. And I mean, that kind of doesn't that kind of get into recovery talk a little bit too? Like, you want to avoid putting yourself in those positions where you're like, well, you've already blown it. You already had a sip of wine. You might as well get blackout drunk tonight, right? Like that idea that like, oh, you've already tainted your purity, so just go ham. I say ham all the time now, thanks to you, by the way. I need to replace
that. You're welcome.
That.
I invented that phrase, and then the kids of America stole it from me and made it popular on TikTok. I was talking about – I mentioned eating a bunch of candy at 11 o'clock. Maybe that's what's made it hard for me to sleep well the last couple of nights. It's weird because I've actually been going to bed kind of early, like maybe 10 o'clock, 9:30 or 10 o'clock. Haven't consumed any alcohol. I've been putting myself in a pretty good spot, I would think, to sleep well. And I haven't been – I've just been kind of a little bit tossing and turning. I don't know if it's just, again, just low-level anxiety from the world. I usually sleep pretty well. But I've been having that thing where I basically at about 5:30 – well, what will happen is at about 5 or 5:30 I'll start to really get into some good sleep, which is exactly when the cat decides it's time to go outside. So that will roust me after about 10 minutes of really good, restful sleep. Let the cat out and then go get back in bed. And then from 5:45 or 6 a.m. until the alarm goes off, which is for me usually like 7 or something, I will sleep the hardest, deepest sleep ever. I wrote this on Twitter today. I was like, the only really good sleep is from basically like 6 a.m. until you realize you have to stop hitting snooze on your alarm. That's the world that I've been living in lately. And it turns out that I may not be alone. There was this research that came out in the magazine Current Biology that basically has been tracking how we've been sleeping during the pandemic, and it finds that people are sleeping much later during lockdown for a variety of reasons. But we're also suffering less what's called social jet lag, which is a term I didn't know about. If I can just summarize this, the basic idea is that people are just kind of fall into one of a few different camps. You're either a person whose circadian rhythm and your kind of natural way of being tends to push you towards getting up a little bit earlier, or you tend to want to stay up a little bit later. But a lot of people, because of the kind of 9-to-5 world we live in, and because of the fact that we put a lot of emphasis on getting up early and being ahead of the game, a lot of people whose bodies and their biorhythms are not really inclined for that, they're doing it, but it's creating something called social jet lag, which a lot of times manifests in sleeping a lot on the weekends and things like that, so that you're just kind of always a little bit, you're exhausted or you're tired and you're just not really functioning at your best because you're just not somebody who's designed to get up at 6 a.m. and be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed by, 7:30 or 8 a.m. working.
Yeah, and so they must talk about working from home, too. I wonder if that's part – I think that working from home has – I don't know, just talking to some friends, it feels like working from home has caused kind of a havoc in blurring the line between when you're at work and when you're not, which could be leading people – I mean, that could be leading some people to have to wake up earlier because somebody scheduled a meeting for them at 8:30, even though during a normal time you would just go to work at 9 a.m. and nobody would be thinking it's okay to do that. I've been hearing some stories like that. But also, I'm sure it's kind of like, well, you're just working later and later into the day because there's a blurry line between what is work. There's a New Yorker that's been going around for the New Yorker cartoon that's been going around for the past few weeks that it seems like it might be an icon of these times when we look back at it. And it's like, am I working from home or living at work? I can't remember anymore. So that must play into this sleep cycle too.
One of the things they were saying in a different article I was reading this morning about this was that to some degree, the early riser advantage has now been eliminated. I know what you're talking about. Like, that's why yesterday I was drinking overly strong coffee, because somebody on the East Coast scheduled a call at 8 a.m. for me. And I was like, let's do the math here, people. I know it's 11 for you, but it's a pretty simple calculation of what it is on the West Coast. But that being the case, in a lot of ways, this early riser thing, because of the blurred lines around when we're working – one article was trying to make the argument that you don't have as much of an advantage if you get up really early and start working. And so that's allowing some people to sleep in a little bit more because we are working from home. We don't have to physically be sitting at a desk at 9 a.m. or whatever. The workflow is changing. And as long as you get your work done, as long as you are delivering the report to the boss or whatever you might do by the time they need it, things are getting a lot more fluid. And that's actually meaning that a lot of people who are not naturally early risers now things have leveled out a little bit. It's more okay to be working on something at 7 o'clock at night. If that's your circadian rhythm or your chronotype, that's fine too now. But that raises the issue of for a lot of us, we're all just kind of in a constant state of working. I actually feel bad because I was emailing with one of the producers at Livewire or texting on Sunday night. Because it's like I'm starting to think about Monday and I'm starting to be stressed about things that we had to do. And it didn't even occur to me, it's Sunday. Maybe this person wants to be left alone. Maybe they want to enjoy their Sunday. And they were like, I'll have it to you by, Monday morning after, actually they were also in on this meeting we had to do. But it's like the lines are getting very blurry, and that I feel like can't be a great thing for everybody to just be in a constant. If you have the privilege of having a job, which is also something that always has to be sort of noted, the fact that it's now become possibly more of a 24-hour exercise, I don't know if that's such a good thing.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't even tell this particular example. And I don't know if this is – I don't know how relatable this is to other people or if it's just my specific living situation. But I do love sleeping in late as much as this story paints me as a, Seth Rogen character. One of the benefits of the 2 weeks – that you were on vacation, and I was still technically working, but I didn't have to wake up at a specific time to post the shows. We already had them recorded. I just had to get them posted at some point, but I was on my own schedule. Well, usually I would sleep in there. Like, even though it was a weekday, if I had my druthers, I would probably sleep in until 9:30 or 10 o'clock on those days, which, again, doesn't paint me in the best light, but I would. I love sleeping in. But Genevieve's office is in our bedroom. So during those 2 weeks, it maybe for the better, but like, again, that line between work and life is very blurry. Like, I'm not sleeping in. If she's getting up to do a Zoom meeting at 8:30 or 9, well, then I need to be up before then, you know?
Yep. For me, it's, I can't remember. This is going to sound like I'm trying to humble brag, and I'm not. I can't remember the last time I slept until 10 in the morning. And it's not because I don't want to. Like, this is where I feel my middle age intensely. Also, if I have had some alcohol, I don't actually sleep super great a lot of times. So maybe if it's a Saturday morning and I was having a few on Friday night, that may contribute to this. But like, I like the idea of sleeping in a lot. Also, the pets don't help because, you know, the dogs, maybe that's actually what's driving it as much as anything, is the dog has a whole system of that she employs, which is at about 6:30 or 7, she'll come to the hallway outside the bedroom door, and she will then collapse on the hardwood floor in the hallway in a heap, like, which is totally like a passive-aggressive move because I can hear it. Then, now in the back of my mind somewhere, it's like, well, is this dog going to start whining? Thankfully, she really doesn't. She's actually pretty calm, but now she's out there. And when she's out there, then the cat's usually emboldened to come start meowing under the door to go out. And if I get up to let the cat out, then the dog, you know, it's a whole bunch of things. But yeah, I like the idea of sleeping in, but I don't, my body just doesn't really let me sleep in very late anymore. I am a huge napper, though. And so maybe that's what happens, is I get up earlier than I really want to, but then I'm tired again by 2 in the afternoon. And that's where I, see, that's my version of sleeping in, the way that you probably on a nice morning, like a nice weekend morning, that great feeling of just kind of, you know, rolling over and staying in bed for another half hour. For me, that's getting back in bed at about 2 in the afternoon, turning the fan on in the bedroom, particularly if like the sheets are clean, just like that's it. That's the best for me.
I've done that, but napping doesn't make me feel good. I mean, I guess sleeping in doesn't make me feel great about myself either, but napping, like, it's always hard for me to wake up from naps. I do it. Like, yesterday was, I don't know why, but yesterday was because I thought I had plenty of sleep the night before, but yesterday around, I finished up work stuff around 4 o'clock and I felt drugged. I felt like I could barely move my arms. You've been so tired but I was like, it's 4 o'clock. Like, if I close my eyes for a moment, I'm screwed. I'll sleep for an hour at the very least, and then I'm waking up in the evening, and then I won't be able to sleep again. So I powered through that. But, you know, what you say about sleeping in has really been true for me too. And I don't know if it's because I have this aging cat who's now like really annoying in the mornings, and he's waking us up as early sometimes as 4:30 or 5:30, and then I wake up and maybe I have to use the restroom, and then by the time I go back to bed, my mind is racing. I don't know if it's a combination of my pets and social anxiety, not social, but the anxiety that we're all feeling in the world and middle age, that might have to do with it too. But like, I can't remember the last time I've had a good relaxing sleep in where the majority of the morning isn't me actually being awake, feeling anxious and scrolling through Twitter, but actually sleeping in.
I wonder if you went to, if you went on vacation somewhere yeah, relaxing, and the pets were at home.
Yeah, good question.
And you were, you know, like maybe Secrets.
Okay.
Or
okay,
just listening. Somewhere where you just were out of, I wonder if the election goes the way I hope it does. I wonder if, like, in, you know, and then let's say there's a vaccine. I'm going to paint a beautiful picture for everyone.
Oh my God. This is nice.
Donald Trump is not president anymore. The president of the country and the vice president are actually trying to keep people safe and wearing masks and encouraging everyone to wear masks and putting policies into place that encourage that. We knock the virus down. At about the same time, we're getting a decent vaccine. Normal life is starting. The green shoots of normal life are starting to come back. Springtime, going into summer. We can travel again. You go to vacation somewhere. You know what? You get to the hotel. Person's like, you want to upgrade for 15 more bucks a night, and you go, you know what, I deserve it. And you get like a nice room, maybe it's got a little view of the water or something, and a big comfortable bed, and you go have a nice dinner, have a few drinks, and then it's Saturday morning, and you wake up in this big, clean, comfortable bed with Donald Trump not being president, no cats bothering you. That, I bet, would be the recipe for sleeping in. Did I just put you to sleep with that whole description?
Yeah. Just go on. Don't stop. Why are you stopping?
People are driving off the road all over
America. I was there.
America.
Why are you stopping?
Like, I mean, you know, in all of this, I hope I'm not like pulling the curtain back too much on our, you know, our pretty frequent texts with our pal Chris Hayes. But like, I had mentioned a conversation that Chris Hayes had with Masha Gessen on his show, and Chris responded to both of us and said, I'm glad your takeaway from that was hopefulness, because that's, you know, I think he is hopeful. And I think there are a lot of reasons to be really, really anxious about the world and about our country. And there are also a lot of reasons to be hopeful. And I mean, I think our bodies and our brains are naturally designed to lean into the anxiety more than to lean into the hopefulness, because that's
as human beings or as you and me. Okay, I wasn't sure.
Well, I think as human beings, because think about it. If you're talking about from an evolutionary standpoint, if you were the hopeful caveman, if you're like, I don't think that saber-toothed tiger is coming over here, you probably didn't have as many offspring as the guy who was like, let's give that thing a wide berth.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're probably wired for us to think about worst case scenarios and to be hyper vigilant, because those were the people that stayed alive longer and had more offspring. And so it's easy in all of the anxiety that we're feeling, that I'm feeling, to lose sight of the fact that there is going to be a day. It's either going to be in, 4 months, or it's going to be in 4 years. I sure hope it's 4 months. That guy's not going to be president. And there is going to be a day that there's going to be a vaccine. There is going to be a day that your kids, if you're listening, are going to go back to school. And, life will return to some sense of normalcy, and people will be waking up in comfortable hotel beds feeling good on a Saturday morning. Like, that is a thing that is going to happen, even though there are times where it feels like we're never going back to that. But we really are at some point, and I think it's important to hold both of those thoughts in our heads as much as possible, to be very aware of the world and to do everything we can to try to move things in the direction they need to go, but also to remember that this is not the rest of our time as a nation or as people, you know? Because that's another thing a therapist will tell you, is the reason that bad things feel so bad is because our brains have this way of saying, this is now how it always will be. Even if you're just in an argument with your significant other and it feels bad, the anxiety is that this is now the state that you're going to live in for the rest of your life. And of course, it's not. And remembering that is huge.
Yeah. I'm still dubious. All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week, I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man, it's not from a female.
All right, emails and V-mails, sir?
Yeah, so I texted Barry earlier. I'll read to you this this text. I think I described it. I said, if you pour a cup of coffee before the entire pot is finished brewing, why is it more strong/bitter than if you wait for the whole pot to finish brewing? That's the question, right? You agree with that?
Yeah, okay. I agree with that.
Simple answer, says Barry. The coffee is more concentrated. Brewing coffee is a science.
If you dose 50 grams of coffee, that calls for 850 grams of water, and you only pour 400 grams of water and take a sip, your ratio is off, and the coffee will taste sharp and bitter. So, that's basically what we said, only he made it more science-y. Did you follow that? A lot of numbers. But there's a certain amount of water that should be matched with coffee, and if we're sipping that stuff early, all of the water isn't in there yet.
Makes perfect sense. And we got it from a recognized coffee knower in our friend Old Barry over there at Broadcast.
That's right. Let's see here. How about licorice? We were talking about licorice on the show, I think yesterday, or was that last week, where there's actually, if you eat too much licorice, it contains something that can be bad for your health, and they think it led to one man's early demise?
Yeah. Construction worker in Massachusetts who didn't appear to have any underlying health conditions other than he ate a lot of candy and had switched over to so-called black licorice a while ago, and his potassium levels, I believe, were down and or up or something. Anyway, yeah, licorice toxicity is a thing.
Sarah on Bainbridge Island says, I definitely had to quit licorice. I love it, and I gobbled myself right into heart palpitations.
Whoa.
When I try a little again, they start right back up. Scares the shit out of me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try anymore, she says. Sarah in Bainbridge.
Wow, because that was total news to me, and it's funny that it's not something that gets talked about more, considering, you know, the amount of licorice that's consumed, right? You know, we also were making the distinction that red licorice is probably not actually licorice. It's probably a red delicious candy. I do like red licorice, by the way. It's a red delicious candy, but it's not doesn't have whatever the thing is that black licorice has. So really, all licorice should just be black licorice, and then the other stuff should be called something different, right?
Yeah, like in fact, I think it's like straw. Isn't it usually strawberry flavored? It should just be like strawberry ropes or whatever. But yeah, and I think that's why you don't hear about it more, is because most people don't like licorice or what we call black licorice. I think most people think of it as bitter. You know, it sounds like kind of an old-timey, old person kind of candy. I say that as somebody who actually does like the flavor of it, but hasn't had it in a really long time. What are
I feel like so much of the stuff that was considered a treat and candy back in the day was just because they didn't have as good of treats, honestly.
Yeah, did you throw a stat at me the other day in one of these stories about how, like, if you lived 100 years ago, there was a good possibility you'd go your whole life without not 100, maybe 150 years ago, you'd go your whole life without having one piece of candy
that wasn't me.
That was made, in some sort of industrial factory setting, and now we eat like God knows, you know, how much candy that doesn't come from our own kitchens.
Well, Andrew, I don't know if you've heard this, but Halloween is definitely happening.
Hey, look around, look at all the Halloween.
Yeah. If Halloween wasn't definitely happening, would you be reading this press release?
Would I have candy on all of my fingers right now?
Look at how it's smeared around my mouth. That's because Halloween is happening, baby.
Look how I melted a Mars bar and wrote hashtag Halloween is happening on my forehead backwards so it looks forward in the mirror. Everything's fine. How have I done this again? No, I didn't. Here, this is from a listener, Becky, but we're going to go on a real journey here, if you'll allow it, Luke.
Ready.
Our conversation about emptying the dishwasher really sparked something, and a lot of people got a lot of feedback on people bemoaning having to empty the dishwasher or talking about arrangements they had with roommates. I remember one person said we had a deal that the first person who needs a utensil from the clean dishwasher has to empty the whole thing, which led to people using crazy ass utensils that were clean and not in the dishwasher just so they wouldn't have to empty it.
It's like one chopstick, a piece of like turkey lunch meat.
Or you're eating Cheerios with one chopstick just by trying to loop them onto the chopstick in the milk. So we got this note from Becky, and this is her way of emptying the dishwasher that she says really helps her, but it goes into a lot of detail, so I want you and the listeners to go along with me here. I will try to slow down a little bit. I feel like I've been talking a mile a minute, and that's not going to help this email. Becky says, I also dislike unloading the dishwasher. Here's how I streamline the task. Feel free to use it privately or on TBTL. Once the dishwasher is finished washing, open the dishwasher door. Remove all the plastics, like Tupperware type of stuff. tap the excess water over the sink, and return the items to the top rack and let them dry there. I kind of do that, actually. Mm-hmm. Then use a towel to soak up the puddles remaining on the coffee cups. Yep, I do that. Keep the dishwasher door open and use a desktop or box fan to finish drying. Now that starts to get pretty complicated. I do leave the dishwasher open. I do everything up until that part. I'll like shake the water off. I'll maybe dab some of the bottoms of the coffee cups, but then I just leave the dishwasher open for a couple of hours. Becky says you could add a desk fan to the situation. Once the dishes are dry, lay two or three kitchen towels out on the counter space above or near the dishwasher. Stand to one side of the dishwasher door and double-handedly unload the top rack onto the towels, working back to front so there's always space to place the dishes during this quick paste unloading. So at first, by the way, I thought she meant just pull the entire drawer out of the dishwasher. That's not what she means. She's just saying as fast as possible, use both your hands and just click, 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 pull everything out of the top rack and put it directly onto the towel that you've laid out. Once the top rack is unloaded, shut the dishwasher door. Grab as much as you can in each hand of like items and return them to their cupboard homes. I can get three coffee cups on one hand and two glasses in the other. So now I'm kind of picturing her just like racing across the kitchen with way too many glasses in her hand. For silverware, take out the entire silverware holder and safely.
That.
Yep, so do I, but quickly dump them on the kitchen towel. I do something similar to that. Sometimes I pull them out of the rack. Sometimes I just scatter them on the kitchen counter. It might seem silly to micromanage this, but it's often a daily task for me and one that is boring, so I like to get it over quickly. That's the key. I can do it in three or four minutes, she says.
I do a version of that, which is, although this morning I did a bunch of dishes, Andrew, so that I wouldn't have to unload the dishwasher.
I've done that.
Two plates, three or four cups, put them on the drying rack. But what I will do if I am unloading the dishwasher and I know that there's going to be a certain amount of residual water is I will spread out a dish drying towel just on the countertop above the dishwasher. So I'm kind of doing what the listeners suggest, but the sort of abbreviated version. So I'll pull everything out that has any kind of water, and I'll sort of, if it has a lot of it, I also never put anything like, I don't put any cups face up so they're going to collect water. Everything is face down, obviously. But anything that's got water on it, I place it on the dish towel, and so then I feel like it gets a little bit of time to dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point I come back. I don't actually hand dry things, but I'll place a bowl that has a little bit of excess water, and I'll place it upside down on the dish towel, and I'll just kind of cover the towel in all of the things like that. And then I'll come back in a little while, and I feel like they've gotten dry enough at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love leaving the dishwasher. Like if somebody else mentioned this too, and I do think this is key. If you run the dishwasher and you go to bed, then they're going to sit in there all night. But if there's any chance that you've run the dishwasher while you're awake and you can be there when it's done its cycle, you can open the door right away and let all that steam out, and then that hot water will dry better. And there's nothing better than looking down at your dishwasher. Because, you know, like I remember being a kid, like we were always told, like if you're washing dishes by hand, rinse them off in the hottest water possible, because then the water will dry off of them quicker. It'll sort of evaporate as opposed to using like tepid water. So if you can get that dishwasher door open immediately after the cycle, you can let all that steam out, and I think all the water will evaporate better, and then the door of the dishwasher will come out looking real clean too. Not that that matters.
The other problem though with that, a lot of those things for us, is the dog. The dog does weirdly understand most of the time. When the dishwasher is being loaded, the dog is right there because she wants to lick any kind of food related spillage. But she does generally understand when it's clean. She's kind of less interested. I mean, her smell, her sense of smell must just let her know that these dishes are relatively clean. But I also wouldn't just leave the dishwasher open with clean dishes, because there's a chance she would walk over and just to investigate, just start licking things. And then I've seen where that tongue goes. We would have to rewash everything. I shudder at the thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do as well. I'm literally shuddering right now, actually.
I mean, that's the biggest, and I think listeners with pets, particularly dogs, although I'll tell you, the cat's got her own problems, but it's like the cognitive dissonance that we have to employ as pet owners who let our pets I don't really let the dog lick my face, but I will let her lick my hand a little bit or my feet sometimes. I love the dog very much, but I see where that dog's tongue goes, and it ain't great.
Yeah.
And I see what the dog eats. We're out on the trail, and I'm not patrolling her. And the idea that I would ever let that tongue come in contact with any part of my body is just because I'm choosing to ignore in that moment where that tongue has been.
Yeah, because love conquers all. I'm with you. That's like, right. Yeah, that's, I mean, right. if I see Rudy and she's going to lick my hand or even my cheek, like, I let strange dogs, if they want to, lick me. I shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah. All right. I think that is that's going to be all for today. The good news, though, everybody, is we're going to be back here tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio for you. So we hope you can join us for that. Until then, enjoy your Tuesday. Hope you're doing all right wherever you are. Thanks again for being part of TBTL. And we'll see you tomorrow. Until then, please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
Power out.